State v. Terry Thomas. Jeffrey W. Jensen will argue first for the defending petitioner, Terry Thomas. Mr. Jensen.
Thank you. If it pleases the court and opposing counsel, I am Jeffrey Jensen, and I appear on behalf of the defendant petitioner, Terry Thomas. There certainly is a temptation when arguing before the highest court in the state, in front of all of these people, to overstate one's case, the significance of one's case. But I don't think I overstate the matter when I say that what is at stake here today before the court are the two most fundamental principles in our criminal justice system. I think this court recognized that in the Garcia case, which is cited by both parties, and Justice Wilcox is concurring, opinion noted that the United States Supreme Court pointed out that the dual aim of our criminal justice system is that guilt shall not escape or innocence suffer, and that's from United States versus Noble. Specifically, what is at stake, I believe, by the issues presented in this case is whether we, as a society, will abide a rule of procedure which will inevitably result in innocent people being convicted of crimes and sentenced to prison. Because if the court accepts any of the arguments presented by the state, I believe that's the inevitable result. As the case has wound its way through the trial court and the Court of Appeals and now up to the Supreme Court, although two legal issues are presented by the briefs, I think there are really three major questions that need to be addressed. The first one is, did Mr. Thomas stipulate to the facts that were recited by the prosecutor at the plea hearing? And I don't plan to spend a lot of time on that because to me it's perfectly clear that he didn't. The second issue, and which I think is really the major issue, and which I referred to in my opening comments, is whether it's required during the course of a guilty plea in a criminal case for the trial judge to ensure that the defendant admits sufficient facts to constitute the crime charge. And the third issue is also a relatively minor issue by comparison, but it's whether the facts recited by the prosecutor, whether the defendant stipulated to them or not, whether those facts were sufficient to create a factual basis to believe that the defendant, Mr. Thomas, was guilty of the crime charged. In reading the transcript for the first time, when I first began working on this case, it never occurred to me that anybody could read that transcript and conclude that Mr. Thomas stipulated to the facts. I would like to read from that transcript just to make it perfectly clear. The colloquy between the court and Mr. Thomas went as follows. The court, do you dispute anything that has just been said, sir? And that question is referring to this reading of the criminal complaint by the prosecutor. And the defendant said, yes. Then the court says, yes, he stipulates, they both stipulate. To me, the transcript is perfectly...
Sure.
Yes.
The transcript is clear. One would expect him to say no.
Correct.
On the other hand, it goes on after that, and nobody then objects. So it's as if and this happens to all of us, you mean yes. Sometimes you hear a double negative and you answer it improperly. Should have been no. But nothing ever happened after that to correct this. So
yes.
It seems to me it was a mistake, and that's how the judge read it.
Well, I don't think it's a mistake, because although there were some things that went on after it, there also was a lot that went on before it. The reason the prosecutor was so concerned about creating this factual basis is because during the entire course of this plea hearing, the prosecutor noted for the court that he won't agree to the criminal complaint. The trial judge was becoming frustrated and annoyed with Mr. Thomas because he would not stipulate to the facts in the criminal complaint. And so there was a this was not simply an isolated comment by Mr. Thomas, completely out of any context, where it seemed like everybody expected him to agree. On the contrary, I think everybody expected him not to agree. So then when the judge asks him, "Do you dispute anything that has just been said, sir?" and he says, "Yes," that makes it clear to me. And beyond that, if we look at what occurred after that comment, the judge uses the word stipulates. They both stipulate. And it's clear, both from the sentencing transcript and from the transcript of the plea hearing, that Mr. Thomas is not a highly educated and highly intelligent person. I don't think there's any reason to believe he knows even what the word stipulate means. That's a legal term of art.
Did he have counsel?
He did have counsel, yes.
You take issue if the court would say, well, let's see, we'll read the whole transcript, looking at everything that's in the entirety, and say, well, it looks like what we have is a totality of the circumstance. In other words, when you read the whole thing, it would seem as the court might do in a banker situation. What do you disagree with that? Do you think that a court could do that or should do that?
Yes, I think the court should consider all of the transcript, the entire transcript, but I think that would also include Mr. Thomas's motion hearing to withdraw his guilty plea, because I think that constitutes a timely objection to his agreement. It's not as though Mr. Thomas filed this motion years later in a 97406 motion or something of that nature. This was his original post-conviction remedy, where he immediately alleged that he didn't agree to the factual basis for the plea. I can't speak for trial counsel why an objection wasn't made.
Mr. Jensen, if you're agreeing with Justice Wilcox that you're going to look at the entire record, isn't there also a colloquy that occurs with the defendant at the time of the sentencing hearing where the defendant appears to agree that the factual basis presented at the time of his plea was a correct one and accepts it?
If you and I are thinking about the same colloquy, the one that I recall was at the plea hearing, the prosecutor made a comment, something along the lines of...
This would be at the sentencing hearing.
Right, at the sentencing hearing. Mr. Thomas, did your lawyer correctly summarize the elements of the crime for you? And Mr. Thomas said, yes. I could find the exact wording if I referred to the reply brief. But I think what was absent from that was any recitation of facts. Mr. Thomas confirmed that there was a discussion between him and his attorney, but there was nothing in that record to establish what these facts were.
What about the plea questionnaire?
Well, I've filled out those plea questionnaires hundreds of times, and I don't recall any question on there about whether there is a sufficient factual basis.
Now, what's your position, as precisely as we can state it? Is it your position that on a guilty plea, the defendant has to admit sufficient facts that establish the crime? Personally?
Yes, that is my position.
So that the fact that the complaint itself is adequate, and the defendant pleads guilty, right?
Yes, I'm with you.
That's not adequate for you.
I think if the complaint itself is adequate and the defendant merely pleads guilty without stipulating that the facts in the complaint
yes.
are true, that is not sufficient.
Okay,
because
why not? Why can't you say, look, he pleads guilty, he has notice of the complaint, right?
Yes.
Why isn't that enough? I don't think there are very many people who don't understand what guilty means.
The reason I don't believe that's enough is several reasons. The first one is, following that procedure would basically mean that there is no requirement that a separate factual basis be established at the plea hearing, because every criminal complaint that survives to the point of a guilty plea or an arraignment will state sufficient facts, because presumably some court at the initial appearance has reviewed it and found probable cause. In other words, that at least enough facts to constitute the crime are alleged. And if all that needs to be done is to find the criminal complaint sufficient, then I think that's the same as saying there really is no additional requirement to create a factual basis at a plea hearing.
Except the guilty plea. So it's your position that if a judge says, I find a factual basis exists to the charge for which the defendant has entered a plea based on the probable cause portion of the complaint, that's not sufficient?
I would argue that's not sufficient, yes.
What about with the stipulation from defense counsel? To the facts in the complaint or summarized by the prosecutor, which is what happened in this case, right? Eventually.
Yes, this was a fairly convoluted plea hearing, especially near the end. And I think at some point, trial counsel does say, in fact, I'm looking at page 29 now, it says, so you'll stipulate to that as a basis for the plea. And Mr. Schnacki says yes. And then it goes on to this section where the defendant refuses to stipulate. And I think if the defendant hadn't been addressed personally, then he would be bound by counsel's stipulation, because certainly an attorney can speak on behalf of his client and enter into stipulations, and I happen to know that happens hundreds of times every day.
Right, so it's not your position that the defendant personally must stipulate verbally on the record at a plea hearing in order to provide the substantial factual basis for the plea?
That would be fair to say. I think a defendant certainly could stipulate through his attorney that the facts in the criminal complaint are true and constitute a sufficient factual basis, but where the attorney makes a stipulation and then the defendant personally repudiates the stipulation, I don't think he can be bound by counsel's stipulation.
So the whole case then turns on this exchange between Mr. Molitor and Judge Hancher and your client and how it is to be interpreted.
I think that's the first step in the analysis. I don't think that is the determinative analysis, but that certainly is the first important question to ask, yes.
Well, interpreting what he meant by that, or how this particular passage in the transcript ought to be read, or what its meaning and import is, don't we have to read it with the other, or in context with the other things that the defendant said at the plea hearing, as well as the sentencing hearing, as well as in his guilty plea questionnaire?
Yes, and I strongly encourage the court to read that in context, because a number of times throughout this plea hearing, the defendant said he does not agree to a lot of the things that were alleged in the criminal complaint. And there's also, and Judge Schudson noted this in his concurring opinion in the Court of Appeals opinion, it's pretty clear that Judge Hancher was becoming annoyed with the defendant and his attorney. And in fact, at one point, he threatened to adjourn the matter until 1:30 and things of that nature. So I have no doubt
for
that...
For what purpose was the human adjourning?
I'm referring to page 28 of the sentencing of the plea hearing transcript, which is also an appendix to my brief. The court says, what do you disagree with the rest of the complaint? It's 12 o'clock. I have a felony judges meeting. I have a jury trial. The attorney is waiting here to find out what's happening on that. I can't sit here. What I'm going to do is pass it and see if there's some disagreement you have and hear it at 1:30. I've never had such difficulty stipulating to a criminal complaint before in my life.
Was this before or after the long yes answer?
This was almost immediately before it.
And then he persists.
Yes. In fact,
the judge persists, but also the defendant persists.
The defendant?
Actually, Mr. Jensen, as I read this transcript, it wasn't the defendant who was weighing in with objections to the factual basis, but apparently there was some problem with the attorney for the defendant disagreeing with some of the facts that preceded the actual shooting in the case, right?
That's certainly true that Mr. Schnacki was objecting to some of the factual basis, but it's also clear to me that he was making those objections based on conversations he's had with his client.
Right, but none of the objections that were being made were to the actual facts of the shooting itself, just the preceding verbal altercation that occurred between the various parties to the shooting. I mean, at the time that Mr. Mulder, the prosecutor, was interrupted, he hadn't even gotten to the defendant's confession yet, right? In his recitation or summarization of the complaint.
I think that's true.
And wouldn't it be fair to interpret this as the judge's attempt to move the prosecutor along in his recitation of the factual basis to get to the defendant's confession so that we could find out whether there was anything about that, which is the operative document here?
Yeah, Judge Hancher certainly was trying to move the prosecutor along, and I think everybody along. That's clear from his comment.
And in addition, didn't the judge ask the defendant at the top of the hearing whether or not he had read the complaints or had them read to him, and he acknowledged that, yes, we both read the complaint and the information, both on the homicide case and the felon in possession case, and he had had both of them read to him. He understood the charges, he understood why he was being charged, etc., and he also acknowledged that in the guilty plea questionnaire, and the guilty plea questionnaire does include a line item that says that and also says he understands how the facts establish his guilt in the case and acknowledges that, correct?
Well, yes. There's no doubt that Mr. Thomas said he had read the criminal complaint or had it read to him and he understood what the allegations were.
And in the guilty plea questionnaire acknowledged how the facts established his guilt. And by definition, therefore, had no dispute with that, since he was willing to plead guilty.
I disagree that by definition he had no dispute with that. And it goes back to the point I've been trying to make, is that if all that need to be done to establish this factual basis at a plea hearing is that the criminal complaint either be read into the record or it be established that the defendant read the criminal complaint and he's pleading guilty, then there really is no requirement for an additional factual basis.
Well, plus his attorney's stipulation that, yes, the complaint can stand as a factual basis, right, as we established just a few moments ago.
Well, I read Mr. Schnocke's stipulation, at least if we're referring to the same stipulation, that's at page 29, that he'll stipulate to what was read as a basis for the plea, and then, as I said, Mr. Thomas repudiates the stipulation, in my opinion.
Counsel, isn't the stipulation, when you refer to the plea advisement and waiver of rights form, more than just a stipulation that he's read the complaint? Number four says, I have read or have had read to me the criminal complaint and the information of this case. I understand what I am charged with, what the penalties are, why I've been charged. I understand the elements of the offense and their relationship to the facts in this case and how the evidence establishes my guilt.
Yes, the defendant is acknowledging that he has read those things and he understands those principles. I don't think that that amounts to a stipulation of fact.
What about establishes my guilt? Those are the last words read.
Right, and the criminal complaint, as I say, by definition, will establish the defendant's guilt as long as it's not dismissed for lack of probable cause.
On the theory you accept it all as plausible.
Yes.
And he's saying, well, if that's what I did, then I'm guilty. That's your interpretation of this record, of what Bradley just read.
I'm sorry, I don't understand the question.
Well, he says that the complaint establishes my guilt. You're saying that means that I agree that if the complaint was proved, that I would be found guilty. If the complaint were proved.
If the complaint were proved.
That's what you're reading that as.
Yes. If the complaint were proved, that would establish my guilt.
Okay. And that's
yes.
What he says in the plea and
right.
The waiver form. That's your interpretation.
That's my interpretation,
form.
Yes.
And that when you go into court and he says, yeah, maybe that's true. I mean, it's like a demur in a civil case, like a motion to dismiss. But if everything's true, okay. But then you're saying, when it gets to court, he's saying, but it's not true.
It's not all true. That's right.
That's your theory of this case.
Yes.
Mr. Jensen, a couple of minutes ago, I asked you some questions about the colloquy that took place at the sentencing hearing.
Yes.
And you indicated that you were reading that colloquy is referring to the elements of the crime. Just went back and looked at the transcript, and this is at C-14 of the appendix in your brief. Mr. Schnocke correctly summarized the stipulation of facts that you agreed to last time in the guilty plea last time. Is that correct? And there's some other statements there, and then the defendant says yes. That sounds like it's a lot more than the elements that he was agreeing to. Sounds like he was agreeing to the stipulation of facts as set forth by his counsel. C-14 of the appendix.
And that when the Mr. Molitor?
Yes.
Yes.
And then the defendant says, huh?
And then there is, are you talking to Mr. Schnocke or the defendant? Mr. Molitor, I'm talking to the defendant. The court, okay, the defendant then answers pretty clearly, I think, yes.
Right, and this to me is like, it's assuming a fact that is not an evidence. Do you still beat your wife like that? Because the court, or Mr. Molitor says, Mr. Thomas, Mr. Schnocke correctly summarized the stipulation of facts that you agreed to last time, in the guilty plea last time. Is that correct? And the defendant says, huh? And that question assumes that there was a set of facts that Mr. Thomas agreed to.
Was this before or after he answers yes when the state says he really meant no?
This was a totally separate hearing. This was the sentencing hearing.
Afterwards?
Yes.
And you think that could be used against your client?
Well, that certainly didn't occur at the sentencing hearing in the statute, and I think the case is clearly say that the factual basis has to exist before the court accepts the plea. But
you
even
don't
if that,
think this can be used against you?
I don't think so, but even if it is used against him, I don't think that establishes that there was a stipulation of fact, much less does it establish what the facts of the stipulation are.
So you think that at the guilty plea stage you can only use everything that preceded the guilty plea? Preliminary, if there was one, et cetera, but that you can't fix it up at sentencing?
Well, I can certainly imagine circumstances where it could be fixed up at sentencing, but I don't think that this fixed it up. That's my point.
Your point is the record is confused.
Yes.
The things that favor your client, things that don't favor your client.
Well, I guess what I'm saying is, in the ordinary procedure, if we did it by the book, the factual basis should exist before the plea is accepted. I can certainly think of a circumstance where, at the sentencing hearing, upon reflection, the judge says, I wasn't entirely happy with the way this factual basis occurred. Mr. Doe, do you agree that you did A, B, C, D, E, F, and G? And the defendant may say yes, and then the judge could say, well, then I reaffirm my acceptance of the guilty plea. I think that would be acceptable, that sort of a procedure, but I do not think that this colloquy between Mr. Molitor, the court, and the defendant establishes, first of all, that there was a stipulation of fact, much less does it establish what the facts of the stipulation were.
Mr. Jensen, if I accept your interpretation of what occurred at the plea colloquy, why was this not then an Alford?
I think that the defendant's attorney was intending to have the defendant enter a guilty plea, and the defendant was exceedingly reluctant to do that and was not agreeing to the facts that were being recited. And there was no discussion about an Alford plea. Why that wasn't considered, I don't know. But that really ties into my second point that I wanted to talk about, is why the court should not extend the very limited exception to the factual basis rule for Alford pleas onto general guilty plea hearings.
But this sounds to me like an Alford plea, if I accept your interpretation. He disputes the fact, but he's pleading guilty. He not even a no contest. It's guilty.
Except that by every case talking about Alford pleas, including the Alford decision itself, talks about that the acceptance of the Alford plea is within the court's discretion. It has to be done in exceedingly rare circumstances where forcing the defendant to assume the risk of a trial could result in catastrophe. And in the Alford case, it was the death penalty that the defendant was trying to avoid. And
why can't the trial court judge say, I'm not taking a guilty, but I view this as an Alford plea and that's accepted? Well, why can't this court say this record is good enough for Alford and we reinterpret it to Alford?
Because I think that would not be a good rule to establish in the state. Judge Fine, in the Court of Appeals opinion, called Alford pleas an abomination to our system of justice. And in the Garcia case, I think this court expressed pretty clear reservations about allowing Alford pleas. And I don't think anybody who practices criminal law can say they don't feel a little bit queasy about having an innocent person plead guilty. I don't think we should take that very rare circumstance and impose it on the entire system.
Counsel, I sort of expected you to say if he wanted to plead Alford, he could plead Alford. Whether the court took it, that's fine. But that no court can put a plea in the defendant's mouth.
Absolutely.
The other thing is, apparently, Mr. Molitor was the assistant DA, I assume.
Yes.
Had a little problem. He didn't think it was a very good record at the police sentence.
That's true.
In sentencing, he says, the court says, where are we on the pre-sentence? And Molitor says, well, before we get to that, I just wanted to clarify two things from the last hearing. I talked to Mr. Schnakey briefly about it. Mr. Thomas, Mr. Schnakey correctly summarized the stipulation of facts that you agreed to last time, the guilty plea last time. Is that correct? So he is trying to clean up a record.
He didn't think
it was so terrific.
That's true.
And that's when the defendant says, huh.
Yes.
So the reliance here would be, with an assistant DA who has some trouble with it, on the defendant saying yes after he said, huh, three questions later.
Correct.
Thank you.
And I see that my time is up.
But you have 5 minutes to rebuttal.
Yes, thank you.
Mr. Becker.
May it please the court. My name is Assistant Attorney General David Becker. I appear here on behalf of the plaintiff respondent. I will basically attempt to structure my argument this morning around the points that were made by opposing counsel during his argument. I think I agree with him in terms of what issue really I think you're in. Well, maybe the issue that has the critical significance is the legal one about whether or not the defendant needs to stipulate or admit to a factual basis. And that's the law that this case is going to create. But I think opposing counsel wanted to get to that and didn't want to get too hung up on this factual dispute about whether or not we in fact had such an agreement or stipulation. But he himself was required to spend some time on that subject of whether or not there was a stipulation or agreement here. And so I want to respond to what he said there and at least in the initial parts of my argument address some of the things that he said.
Okay. If you don't mind, as you very well know, and maybe this was unfair to Mr. Jensen, the legal question is probably, at least initially, the more significant one. Because if you answer the legal question, must the defendant admit to factual basis, and you say no, then you don't have to ever get to the facts.
Right.
So why not, if you don't mind.
Start with that.
Start with that. Painful as it may be.
I'm raring to go to respond to these things that you said.
I know. And we can get muddled up into the ha's and the s's, which yes. The court explored so that we understood the facts. So, if you don't mind, Mr. Becker.
Okay. If there's some time at the end, I'll give you my shot on the, factual dispute. In our brief, I laid out five reasons why I do not believe that a defendant needs to agree to the factual basis that the prosecution submits fulfill the factual basis requirement that is now statutorily codified in 971.08. And those five reasons were, in summary fashion, were as follows. The first one was the initial case law recognition, before there was a 971.08 requirement, the initial case law recognition of the factual basis requirement came in a case by the name of Ernst many years ago. And that, in turn, Ernst, in turn, was based on the federal Rule 11, which provided, much like our 971.08 presently does, that there has to be a factual basis. The judge must be satisfied that there's a factual basis for the defendant's plea. The federal decisions, and I laid them out in my brief, both expressly and implicitly recognize that you don't have to have an admission from a defendant to comply with federal Rule 11's factual basis requirement. And in that regard, I think those cases that implicitly recognize it are very strong in that regard, because what they basically say is you don't have to involve the defendant at all in the factual basis, in fulfilling the factual basis requirement. I gather what those cases are saying. There either is a factual basis or there's not a factual basis. The prosecution has the obligation to come forward and set out before the court the evidence that it would prove to establish the defendant's guilt. And if it has that evidence and it satisfies the court that there is sufficient evidence to prove the defendant's guilt, then we have a factual basis, and we don't need to involve the defendant or his counsel, for that matter, in that process at all. Full series of federal decisions, and I've cited them and quoted from them in my brief, say. That was our first argument. Our second argument is, when we now look at the statutory codification of the Ernst requirement in 971.08, we see no reference whatsoever to the defendant admitting or the defendant stipulating to the factual basis. And we think that that supports our argument. We also think that no need for the defendant's participation because it is not really required by the purpose of the factual basis requirement. The purpose of the factual basis requirement, I guess there are probably many purposes, and I suppose at least one subsidiary purpose is to protect a defendant, to make sure he's knowingly and intelligently entering his plea, but that's also protected by all kinds of other things that we require in the plea colloquy. And with regard to the factual basis, I think the primary thing we're concerned about there is simply to assure the court and the system that we don't have an innocent person pleading guilty. And that function is satisfied, and that purpose is satisfied if, in fact, as I said earlier, the prosecutor can come forward and lay before the court evidence that the court believes satisfactorily shows that there is evidence to support the defendant's guilt. And we don't need the defendant's participation in that to satisfy that requirement. The fourth argument I made was that obviously if you needed a defendant's admission of the facts to provide a satisfactory factual basis, you couldn't have Alford pleas. So the very fact that Alford pleas have been recognized show that you don't need a factual basis. And in fact, the Alford plea situation is even much, much worse than what we've got here. The classic Alford plea situation, U.S. Supreme Court confronted in the Alford case, was light years worse than we've got here. Here we've got a defendant who is saying, "I am pleading guilty and I am guilty." All he's doing is he doesn't agree with the facts, although I don't think to this day we know what he doesn't agree with in the facts.
Whose job is to do that, to establish that? Defense or state? And if you don't understand it, why don't you just go to jury trial?
Whose job is it to
establish whether he... what the facts are that he does or doesn't plead to?
I think that by analogy to the Bangert decision and how Bangert said we are to treat other defects in the plea process, there is at least an initial threshold burden on a defendant when he's coming forward in a post-conviction motion, as this defendant did, and saying that there is no factual basis, or that he's saying, first of all, I don't think he said it in his post-conviction motion that he really disputed. If he's going to do what this defendant did in his post-conviction motion, which is basically set out in that motion the exchange on which he's relying, and then saying, under that exchange, I disputed, or the record shows then that I disputed, I think he's got to, in that kind of situation, he's got to go further, and he has got to tell us what the nature of the dispute is, because it may be a completely inconsequential dispute. If we were to find out, if we could find out what he disputed, we might find out that he disputed first name of one of the witnesses was misspelled or something in the complaint, or I don't know. It might be something completely inconsequential. I think by analogy to Banger, he's got some threshold burden to come forward and show us that he does dispute something that in fact has some significance to the question of whether or not the factual basis does, or a factual basis does exist. The fifth reason
well,
that...
Before you get to the fifth reason, if you could stay on the fourth for just a moment. If your position that you've stated in your brief and then again here today is the one that we adopt, then isn't it correct to state that every plea is essentially an Alford plea?
Every guilty plea.
Because if it's... If the defendant admits it, then he's guilty. But if he doesn't admit it, it's automatically an Alford plea. So...
Well, I certainly am not going to do it. I would not go that far because what we have here is under the defendant's reading the record, it wasn't simply that he didn't admit it. And he himself admits that an attorney can make the required admission or stipulation, and in this case, the attorney did. But he is saying, I don't want to put words in his mouth, but what I think is involved here and why we're here is because it wasn't simply a failure of the defendant to admit, but under the defendant's reading the record, an affirmative dispute with one or the other of the facts that the prosecutor was proffering in support of the plea. In that kind of situation, you're starting to approach an Alford plea situation, and I, in my brief, suggested that relying on a federal decision that this might be a species of Alford plea. It certainly does not go as far as I said earlier, as Alford went, where the defendant in Alford affirmatively protested his innocence. We have never here had an affirmative protestation of innocence in the context of that, or we did not have an affirmative protestation of innocence in the context of the guilty plea.
Mr. Becker, though, if it's a species of Alford plea, then it requires a heightened factual basis, doesn't it?
And Mr. Becker, look at your brief at page 8. As will be shown in the following paragraphs, if the defendant disputed the proffered factual basis for his plea, then he entered an Alford plea. Last paragraph, then you go through the two species of Alford plea. Then you say, if the defendant actually disputed the factual basis proffered in the case, as he claims he did, then he entered an Alford plea of the second type. He refused to admit to acts constituting the crime. If, as the defendant contends, the Alford plea decisions regarding the factual basis requirement should be limited to cases involving Alford pleas, this is such a case under the defendant's view of what occurred here, and those decisions are fully applicable here. Now, maybe that's not what you intend, but when I read it, I read that as to saying we can just switch this guilty plea into an Alford-type plea, which is what I think Justice Babbage's question was, and then, as I understand Justice Seitz's question, if that's true, then the judge was put on notice, because we all worry about the Alford plea. I mean, it's in every case that deals with an Alford plea, even if you accept the Alford plea, and what you have is a judge saying, hallelujah, we've got a deal. I'm sorry, that's not precisely what you said, but it was close enough.
Okay, 2 points then. I want to be very clear here. The question that was put by Justice Babbage was whether or not we turn all pleas into Alford pleas if we don't insist that we get an affirmative admission. And I am saying, even consistent with what I argued here in my brief, we will not go that far, because under what I argued in my brief, what potentially makes this an Alford plea and makes it the, at least the species of Alford plea that this Sixth Circuit decision recognized is the fact that, that it's not simply a matter that he never admitted, it's that he, under his reading of the record, affirmatively disputed. And that starts to take on some of the characteristics of an Alford plea. Now, you're absolutely right. If you buy into the argument that I made here based on that federal decision, that what we have in this case, and like I say, I don't think that this can now be extended to all cases in which we don't have an admission, because this is a case where there was allegedly the affirmative dispute. If you extend Alford to those cases, and it would be an extension because this is not the classical Alford. This is not the situation that was in front of the U.S. Supreme Court in Alford, which was an affirmative protestation of innocence. This is simply a dispute about some fact, which to this day, like I say, we don't know what that fact is.
Just so I can focus myself, yeah. So I can listen to you, your argument. Can this court, or can a court of appeals, or can a circuit court, where there's some dispute here, and you don't have to concede this dispute, okay? Can that court, or this court, turn a guilty plea into an Alford plea and apply Alford rules? That's the way I read your, is it number four or five?
Yeah.
The number four.
And I think that is a possibility.
Okay.
I don't particularly want to win on that basis here because it creates the additional problem that then we bring in the requirements of Alford, and the critical requirement there is strong proof of guilt. Now, I think we have got strong proof of guilt here, and I don't think I lose this case, but I'm not so sure that I want to, that I necessarily want to win on this point and thereby require, or thereby trigger that strong proof of guilt requirement that attends Alford, please, because in this kind of a situation which goes beyond Alford, I think we have, in that there is not a protestation of innocence, I'm not so sure that we have to be so concerned about strong proof of guilt.
But your argument seems to be, Mr. Becker, and that relates back to your first argument, or first and second arguments, I guess. You seem to be saying to us, we do not need an affirmative admission by the defendant at any point, so long as there is a guilty plea and there is an adequate basis in the record to establish the facts of the crime. That seems to be your bottom line position. Am I wrong?
That's absolutely my position. Now, do I leave you confused, though?
No, but then sounds to me, I mean, are you saying that Alford has a higher a standard than that The record establishes that there is a basis in the record for finding of guilt?
Well, I don't think there's any question about that. If we were dealing with a true Alford plea, there's no question that a critical component of the Alford of the taking of an Alford plea is that we have this additional requirement of strong proof of guilt.
There's also a requirement of an inducement to enter into the plea, isn't there? Requirement of an inducement, some...
Well, I don't know that that's a requirement. I mean, the defendant may have... that's what's always lurking in the background, is that the defendant has some reason why he wants to enter a guilty plea even though he believes he's innocent. And that may or may not get spread on the record. In Alford, it was a real obvious one. He faced the death penalty if he went to trial, but if he took the deal that was offered, he could only get 30 years.
Right, and here on this record, we have no amendments of the charge downward. We have no dismissal of counts.
No.
We have no particularly enticing sentencing recommendation, right?
That's why this is plainly not the classic Alford situation. And it was only, I suppose, because I stumbled upon the Sixth Circuit decision that suggested that there may be another species of Alford plea and thought, boy, that's a nice answer to the defendant's argument here. He entered an Alford plea.
Yeah, but the state really
If I had to do it all over again today, would I think maybe two or three times before I made that argument? because, like I said, I think it perhaps saves this case, but I think it may create more problems than it is worth for future cases and for the development of the law. So.
It was... My view when I read that I was going to ask you, is it the state's position that a judge may change a guilty to an Alfred. And I gather from your response it would not be...
Certainly not our preferred position.
Okay.
And I suppose it's... If we can't convince you on anything else, then that's the last thing you'll have to consider. And
you're going to have to live with it in the state, and the state generally would have to.
Yeah, and I don't think that would be the...
You're swallowing hard.
Yeah.
Is that right?
That's right. That's right.
But why shouldn't there be... Why should there be two different levels of proof necessary? One high level of proof for the Alfred, and one less... level of proof or less level of basis for a defendant that, at least on the record, has indicated that he disputes something?
Well, because I think that something is the critical thing in that question. If I knew that he disputed something that was critical to his guilt, well, then I guess we've moved pretty much into the exceedingly close to the Clouse.
Is that his fault, or is that the fault of the state, or the court?
Well, that we don't know.
That we don't know.
Well, it's certainly his fault because he didn't identify it in his post-conviction motion. Simply relied on the exchange. Now, I say that recognizing that in his post-conviction motion he did make some allegations about a potential self-defense defense, but I see that as a separate and distinct issue from whether or not there was a dispute about anything that had been... That's not disputing anything that had been recited by the prosecutor. That's saying there's something else going on here that I could have testified to, and I could have brought witnesses to testify to, and that's that we were... that I was acting in self-defense. And there are hints of that. I mean, and there are already hints of the self-defense claim in the complaint and the defense statement that he thought somebody was firing at his friend and he was firing wildly back. But I don't see that as identifying a dispute with the prosecutor's recitation of the facts. So I think it's fair for me to say, as I have said continuously during this argument, that in his post-conviction motion, he hasn't really identified, or he did not identify what he disputed. He did add that there were other facts that maybe should have been brought out.
Well, there was also a passage in the transcript involving a colloquy between the court and the defendant, particularly as to his waiver of the self-defense.
Absolutely
argument.
Correct.
And
absolutely.
A line item in the guilty plea questionnaire to that effect as well. So to the extent that that's the basis of the attack on the factual basis, he waived that.
Absolutely, and that's the point we made in our brief in the Court of Appeals, where this whole question of whether or not there was a factual basis, even if he agreed to it. What was characterized as the third issue this morning, whether the facts were sufficient to establish a factual basis, that issue was not raised in this court. But if this court at all wants to see what the state's position is with respect to that, we answered that argument at length in the Court of Appeals brief because that was expressly raised as an issue in the Court of Appeals, and that was part of what we relied on with respect to the self-defense defense that. If he wanted to claim self-defense, then he should have not pled guilty. He should have gone to trial and presented those facts, and the judge. You're waiving your right to present those facts supporting self-defense.
Mr. Becker, why doesn't the court adopt the following rule? That in a guilty plea, assuming you have a very detailed questionnaire form that says, have you read it, are all the facts correct, do you admit them, blah, blah. Why don't we say, defendant shows up and the judge merely says, did you read this, has it been read to you, do you have any changes in any of your answers? Defendant says no. You enter the guilty plea. And let's do away with all this colloquy. And then we won't get into these fine points. First of all, is that legal?
Well, I have a question as to whether... I'm not sure it is. I don't think you can completely rely on a guilty plea questionnaire. And the reason for that is... And now we're talking not just about, obviously you're talking across the board now with
sure.
regard to all the requirements.
Sure.
We're not focusing
we're not
just
focusing
on a factual
fact.
Basis.
Right.
But I think where it fails is because of what 97108 says regarding what the trial court must do. And it says, shall do, before the court accepts a plea of guilty or no contest, it shall do all of the following. One, address the defendant personally and determine that the plea is made voluntarily and understand, or with understanding of the nature of the charge.
I addressed him personally and I said, is there any change in your question, in your answers? You've read it, is there any change?
Well,
I mean, I find your answer to that contradictory to your page 5, number 2 discussion. First of all, 971.8.2 just codifies Ernst, right? And it
right.
doesn't require the defendant admit the facts. Okay, so what's the matter with what I'm suggesting? You don't think it's good enough under... Is it good enough under Ernst, what I just suggested?
Well, I think with regard to the factual basis, it's probably good is good enough under 971.08 because I... As I said, we had moved away, in responding to your question, I said we were moving away from just focusing on factual basis to the whole plea colloquy, and I simply suggested, and I'm not ready to take a position one way or the other because it's not this case at all,
right.
as to just how much it's got to be involved in that personal addressing of the defendant. But with regard to the factual basis requirement in 971.08, there is nothing along those lines. It simply says that the judge make such inquiry as satisfies it that the defendant in fact committed the crime charged. Doesn't say who he has to make that who that inquiry has to be addressed to. We know primarily it's addressed to the prosecutor in all cases. The defendant rarely, if ever, affirmatively asked to provide the factual basis. The judge turns to the prosecutor for that to fulfill that obligation. If the defendant gets involved at all, he's involved in a question or two addressed to him or to his counsel at the end of that proffer of a factual basis. So with respect to if we once again return our focus to the factual basis requirement, then I don't think that there is any problem, except that I'm not so sure that a plea questionnaire in itself is going to contain sufficient information, because just as a defendant, I don't think is required to admit. I don't know I don't think a defendant's admission in itself will satisfy the factual basis. In other words, a simple, straightforward statement, "I've read the complaint and the complaint supplies a factual basis for my guilt," I don't think the court can rely on that. The court must make inquiry such as satisfies it that the defendant in fact committed the crime charged. I don't think he can rely on the defendant to do that. He has to independently look at those allegations of the complaint.
Judge.
I'm sorry, did I?
It was E.
Judge. I don't think that the judge can rely on the defendant for that. He has an independent obligation to make sure that the defendant isn't mistaken. I mean,
that's the Johnson case, right?
Yeah.
Which was mine out of the circuit court. The aspartation element for
yeah, exactly. And you have to you need to make an independent determination based on what has been proffered as a factual basis. Very often the allegations of the complaint, and see once if those satisfy you. And so I'm very reluctant to agree that we can create these summary plea procedures. I think it's just fraught with way too much danger. And at both ends, I think with regard to establishing the defendant's understanding, we need some sort of a personal colloquy that goes beyond, I think, just asking, you read it all, you understood it, and that's it. Although that may come very close, but like I said, that's not this case, and I'm not prepared to really discuss that intelligently.
Okay, I just wanted to see if we could cut through this, have a nice bright line rule, get rid of all of this, and then not have to fight about the facts as to whether or not there has been a guilty plea, whether the facts are admitted.
I think there has to be an independent determination by the judge that the facts admitted do constitute, or that the facts that have been proffered, however they have been proffered, do in fact show that the defendant committed the crime.
You only have 5 minutes. It's my fault you got on to this. Well, why don't you tell us the facts here as you see them, and why the defendant, as I understand it, did admit the facts, and the judge made the kinds of decisions you say the judge should make.
Right. This, as I understand it now, we're turning to the question of whether or not the defendant did in fact stipulate or admit to these facts. And of course, I'm not going to suggest to you in any way, shape, or form that the record is absolutely clear. In fact, if you're looking for, I mean, there's clearly an exchange between the court and the defendant that viewed in the abstract unequivocally suggests just the, or unequivocally establishes, I suppose, if you're going to view it in the abstract, just the opposite. Do you dispute what the prosecutor has just said? And he says yes. And I'm not saying that the transcript is wrong and that he really said no, but what I'm saying is that the trial court's finding that the proper interpretation of that exchange in light of the totality of what had gone on here, and including the totality of what has gone on since, that was properly interpreted by the trial judge as an agreement, not as it appears to be on its face a dispute. And I just want to respond to some arguments that were made here. Well, first of all, let me say overarching principle. I think Chief Justice Abramson hit the nail on the head when she said there are some things in this record that are in your favor and there are some things that don't favor your position. You said that to my opponent when he was arguing.
I said the same thing to you, Mr. Chairman.
Exactly. And therefore, it becomes extremely critical as to what the standard of appellate review is. That's what this case is going to turn on. If I had to affirmatively convince you that this defendant agreed with the facts, I don't think I could bear that burden, because I think that exchange would erect too high a wall, and the other things that I want to deduce I don't think would allow me to scale that wall. But I don't have to convince you of that. All I have to convince you is that the trial court's conclusion that I'm trying to defend was not clearly erroneous, that it was not against the great weight and clear preponderance of the evidence, the two alternate formulations of review of findings of fact. And so that I guess, technically speaking, although I'm stepping out on a limb here, even if you were to conclude that the trial court was wrong, that he was in error in reaching the conclusion he did, you'd still have to go another step. You'd have to say he was clearly in error.
And even if, what's the fact? You said that we review that the fact-finding is not clearly erroneous. What is the fact that we're reviewing?
That the defendant agreed.
Defendant what?
Agreed. The defendant did not dispute the facts. And I suggest to you that under the burden that I have under the appropriate standard of appellate review, I can succeed here. Because while there are plenty of things that go against me, there are plenty of things in this record that support me. And I don't think the things that go against me are quite as bad as opposing counsel would suggest. And I suspect I'm very close to the end of my argument, but I'll try and just hit on some of these things that he has said. He talks about going back and looking at the prior exchanges where there was an indication that the defendant wasn't ready to stipulate the various things in the complaint. I'm not so sure that doesn't help me, it doesn't help me as much as it hurts me, because as they went through and defense counsel said, we don't agree with this one, DA says, okay, let's set that one aside. And when they got down to those last, and in particular with regard to what Justice Sykes said earlier about there was some dispute about the language that had been used that kind of started the whole confrontation that resulted in the shooting of the victim. Later on, when they're going to agree as to what in the balance of the complaint they could consider or not, defense counsel says, okay, we're ready to stipulate to the rest of it with the exception of the statement of a particular witness that's at the bottom of, I think, page 5 and the top page 6. Page numbers, I guess, are irrelevant of the complaint. And so what we had done prior to the point where the defendant is asked to whether he disputes it or not, we had basically cleared away all of the things that he disputed. So the fact that he was disputing earlier things, I don't think tells us anything about whether or not he was in fact disputing what was ultimately offered after we had cleared away the things that he was disputing, as his counsel informed the court that during the course of this colloquy.
Except they haven't gotten to the defendant's confession yet, right? And never ultimately did on the record.
No, they did. As I read it, that's what's involved in that final.
No, it's the interview with Zoris.
Yeah,
the confession doesn't come till the end of the complaint, and they never got that far. Zoris, I think, is the victim's brother?
As I read this record, and my red light is on and off, but I'll take the opportunity to answer this question. Maybe I am reading it wrong.
They got up to the medical examiner, actually, and in the chronology of the complaint...
No, here. Page 28. You are right in terms of what the prosecutor was reciting. But now at page 28, the court asks, middle line 9, what do you disagree with the rest of the complaint?
Okay, he's soliciting
stipulation. Maybe we're on the same line, but I'm saying that then he said what he disagreed with. And then, okay, the prosecutor said, okay, set those aside. Will you stipulate to the rest? Yes, and then turned to the defendant and said whether he agreed. So I think they had, between what the prosecutor had orally recited and what had just gone on with regard to now, what do we carve out of the rest of the complaint and what do we leave that you agree with, they had covered the whole complaint by the time we got to the question about the dispute.
So we can look beyond this transcript to the complaint itself, because it was ultimately stipulated to by the defense attorney verbally and also by the defendant, if we interpret this exchange in the way that you're asking us to.
Exactly correct.
Okay. Mr. Becker, what is your authority for the fact that the standard of appellate review is whether the trial court's finding that he entered a guilty plea and agreed to the facts is not clearly erroneous?
Well, I thought I had laid that out fairly clearly in my brief, I'm not sure if I can find it right now, but this court has...
Page 10.
Yeah, well, going on beyond that, though...
Started.
That's where the discussion starts, and...
Where you start citing cases.
But I thought I had one that specifically said that the meaning of an answer to a question is a question of.
What about footnote 4? I'm just trying to figure out what exactly. Fine, you get that.
Wait a second. Maybe it's bottom of page 11. This court has labeled a conclusion regarding, quote, the proper meaning of a response, unquote, during judicial proceedings as a trial court's finding. That's our primary authority for the proposition that's...
I haven't reread.
I must admit I did not read that.
For a while, is that this kind of plea?
I don't know that it is. I doubt that it's even a plea situation, and I will... candidly confess that I did not reread Cartagena, which is what I cite there in preparation for this argument. I'm willing to bet it is not a plea situation. That would have been too fortuitous, I think, to have found a case that pretty much zeroes right in on what we're talking about here and involved it.
It's a good quote. Whether it's applicable to this fact, we don't know yet.
I sure hope it is. If not, I'm in trouble.
Before you sit down, just a quick overall here. In order to satisfy or to accept a plea of guilty, what must be established? What are the various things?
I would just direct you to. I'm not prepared to answer that question. That in SM 32, you've approved that. I think that lays out a wonderful colloquy, which, by the way, does not involve, with regard to factual basis, a turning to the defense.
What is knowing and voluntary?
Yeah, and I don't, and I think that's a completely separate, distinct issue from the factual basis issue that we've got here today. Where it comes in is when the judge.
That is not an issue here whatsoever.
Was raised, was it not? I don't disagree with you.
I don't...
It was raised at the post-conviction. And in response to my question, Mr. Becker, you weren't willing to get rid of the plea colloquy because you figured you'd have to show voluntary and
intelligent. And that's all those questions that the judge puts to the defendant regarding the nature of the offense, the penalties to which he's subjected, asking him whether he understands that he's waiving any potential defense that might appear on the horizon based on what you know about the case. It's a classic case where there was a potential self-defense issue here, I suppose. I don't think a meritorious one, and I, again, directed my Court of Appeals brief to where we dealt with or showed that there was no real meritorious self-defense defense claim here, but it was obvious that's what the defendant was thinking in terms of, I shot because somebody was shooting at us kind of thing. But those are the kinds of things that the court has to do to establish the intelligent and voluntary nature, and I guess our position is what we've been talking about today, the factual basis, is really something completely separate and distinct. Now, it can help reinforce, as a subsidiary purpose, it can help reinforce the fact that the defendant knowingly and intelligently entered his plea, but it's not critical to that. That's been established by the rest of the colloquy. What we're concerned about here now is kind of a systemic concern, a concern of the system that we not convict an innocent person, and to do that, we simply say, prosecutor, tell us what you would have been able to prove, and we'll see if that convinces us that, indeed, you could have taken this case to trial and convinced the jury, so...
Do you think it's better practice?
Not so fast, Mr. Becker.
Do you think it's better practice for trial courts to get the admission to the facts out of the defendant's own mouth? And should we be recommending that?
Well, no question, and the lower court said that in a phrase that is a good idea. There's no question. I mean, we wouldn't be here today. Either that or leave well enough alone. You've got to applaud this prosecutor for his attempt to nail down everything during the course of this plea, and including trying to make sure later on that there was no problem. But if he had just left well enough alone, as opposing counsel himself admitted, if we had stopped after they had turned to the defense counsel and said, "Can that serve as a factual basis?" And the defense counsel had said, "Yes," and that was the end of it, we wouldn't even, you know, be here. So some things are a good idea, but at another level, sometimes it's better to just leave well enough alone and not create a problem, which is what basically happened in this case.
Why can't we just say, as a rule of law, following up the Chief Justice, why can't we just say that if we examine the record as a whole, that it is clear from the record that the plea entered was a knowing, voluntarily given plea. That's all we have to have.
Because that's not all you have to have. That's sub 1 of 97108.
Right.
Sub 2 says
right.
The judge has to satisfy himself if it's a factual basis.
Right.
And the question becomes whether we can say that the judge could under this record with this supposed dispute satisfy himself that there was a sufficient factual basis.
Thank you, Mr. Becker.
Thank you.
Mr. Jensen, you have 5 minutes of rebuttal.
I'm going to have to go fast, but I submit there is no...
Speak as quickly as Mr. Becker.
How faster?
we haven't heard any.
Okay. Chief Justice
Abramson.
I should explain
to everybody, and this is not off your time. Mr. Becker is a longtime Attorney General. He is very frequent before court and is accustomed to tough questioning and handles it extremely well and is accustomed to being, accustomed to having his speed of speech attributed to it, and the court speedily hears now.
And it's
well
clear,
done.
It's clear that the court enjoys it.
That's
that doesn't
right.
mean that he's going to win.
Or lose. But Mr. Jensen.
Yes, Chief Justice Abramson, you asked why doesn't the court create a bright-line rule? And I would like to respond to that. There is no need to create a bright-line rule because a perfectly good bright-line rule already exists in Ernst versus State. This court said, and it's perfectly clear to me, quote, "The record must also indicate that the conduct which the defendant admits constitutes the offense charged in the indictment or information or an offense included therein to which the defendant has pleaded guilty." I think that is a perfectly good rule. It's only the state and the District 1 Court of Appeals which feels that we should take this perfectly good rule and throw it out the window in favor of imposing Alford plea principles on regular everyday guilty pleas. Now, I spend virtually every day of my professional career sitting in the criminal courtrooms and talking to people and observing how defendants plead guilty, and I'm here to say that defendants are willing to plead guilty for all kinds of inappropriate reasons. They're not happy with their lawyer, they don't like being in the county jail, they would rather go to prison, they don't want to have to involve their girlfriend as a witness. There are all kinds of reasons why. And if we abandon this Ernst versus State bright line rule in favor of establishing a factual basis by reading the criminal complaint, even though there's no agreement, by permitting the prosecutor to simply summarize what he or she thinks she would be able to prove that the case proceeded to trial, will guarantee that innocent people are convicted and go to prison. And I think it is a bad idea to allow people to be, even if it's a knowing and voluntary guilty plea.
But the counsel, just to take issue with you there, if instead of saying yes, he had said no, he could still be lying. I mean, how can any system guarantee that people who want to plead guilty are going to jail or something, even though they're not guilty?
Right. And I admit our system is not perfect, and I think that is the whole principle behind Alford, that you shouldn't force a person to assume a grave risk in an imperfect system. But I think we get closer to perfection by requiring the defendant, and I know of some judges who put the defendants under oath, put them under oath and make them say what they did and then determine whether that conduct constitutes the offense with which they're charged. And to abandon that perfectly good, logical, bright-line rule in favor of something less, I think State takes a step in the wrong direction, a direction we do not want to take. And that is, that will guarantee that innocent people are punished, will guarantee that innocent people go to prison. And I don't think that innocent people should, even if the plea is knowing and voluntary, and the person understands what they're doing and why they're doing it, I don't think people should be allowed to consent to go to prison and be convicted, because there are two wrongs that occur when that happens. The first wrong is that an innocent person suffers, and the second wrong is that if the innocent person is punished for that crime, the guilty person goes free.
How can the judge legitimately then, in your view, obtain the admission under Ernst?
I think by the way it's commonly done, and I think it's a perfectly acceptable procedure, is to ask the defendant and or his attorney, do you stipulate or agree to the facts alleged in the criminal complaint? And if the defendant or his lawyer says, yes, we do, I think that satisfies the Ernst rule, because the defendant is admitting specific conduct. I think that goes one step further than just having the prosecutor recite these allegations without some agreement by the defendant.
But again, the stipulation from defense counsel would be enough, so this is the proverbial case of one question too many.
I would say that's exactly a fair summary of what this case presents, is one question too many. Yes. And I encourage the court, and I really am here pleading with the court, not to create a new bright line rule, but to simply reaffirm the bright line rule that already exists, that was talked about in State versus West, talked about in State versus Johnson, and as recently as 1995, mentioned in State versus Garcia, and in Garcia this court said that accepting an Alford plea isn't inconsistent with the Ernst rule. So it seems to me, at least as of 1995, the Ernst rule was still a good law. And that's all I have at this point on that issue.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, Mr. Jensen. Thank you, Mr. Becker. That ends the hearing on State v. Thomas. The court will take a few moments.